Gavin, you're going to have to pull me off the ceiling on this one.
You do your best work on the ceiling.
You know it.
Hello and welcome to the next episode of Beneath the Law. This one's really got Stephen Teal fired up and ready to rumble. Stephen,
I'm ready to dig into this dry topic of mandate letters and have a juicy discussion with you, Gavin.
Oh, wow. Okay, well, so fasten your seatbelts, everybody. Today, we're really going to get into a case that went up to the Supreme Court of Canada and has caused all sorts of pearl-clutching and hand-wringing, and the sky is falling, and there's been more Chicken Littles running around than you can shake a stick at, Stephen. So why don't you give our listeners a quick sort of update on what this one is about and what happened and why were they up in the Ottawa arguing this incredibly important issue, and why on earth are all these people having such angst about what's going on?
Yeah, people are tripping all over themselves, Gavin, on this decision because this really strikes at the heart of democracy. And I got to tell you, I'm going to say it, the liberal media just doesn't get it on this one. They're basically trying to undermine Canada's constitution. So let's talk about what this case is about. This is about mandate letters. So mandate letters, for those who are unaware, are basically instructions or views given to cabinet ministers by the leader of government, in Ontario's case, the premier, or all provinces, the premier of a province, setting the tempo. Setting the tempo of cabinet deliberations as to what policies a government will adopt. So, CBC News was not happy. They made a request for these cabinet letters from 2018 when Premier Doug Ford was first elected. Cabinet Office denied that. CBC then went to the Information and Privacy Commissioner to get those letters disclosed. The Information and Privacy Commissioner ruled in favor of CBC. Cabinet Office, the government basically argued that those letters were subject to cabinet record confidentiality and an exception to disclosure. A judicial review was brought by the government. Divisional Court denied that judicial review. The Ontario Court of Appeal, in a 2-1 decision, upheld the decision of the Divisional Court, and the government then went to the Supreme Court of Canada, who, in a very, very good judgment, very reflective of democracy principles and the entire cabinet confidentiality issue that allows government to run effectively, reversed the decision of the Ontario Court of Appeal, the Divisional Court, and the IPC Commissioner's decision, and ruled that those mandate letters could not be disclosed. So that, in a nutshell, is what this case is about.
Yeah, I know some people will go, well, wait a minute, why is everything not open and transparent? And I think, and I certainly reading angst-filled comments from various opposing politicians, including the leader of the opposition and the leader of the Green Party, the feeling seems to be, well, this is just unaccountability, and this is secrecy, and this is this sort of star chamber type government, and they're hiding things, and it's a hidden agenda, the usual saws that we hear from those types of people. But I think what they fail to see is that there's a big difference between campaigning for elected office and actually being in government. Governing is something that requires all sorts of reflection. It takes all sorts of issues. And I think there has to be some zone of confidentiality and privacy, as there are in many types of scenarios in society, before public statements are made. And that's exactly what governments are required to do, should be doing, and they shouldn't be afraid that everything that they do or say is going to be on the front page of the newspaper just because they thought about it.
Well, for sure. And, you know, you allude to the fact that there's a zone of confidentiality around government, just like there are zones of confidentiality around other relationships. You know, I view the cabinet confidentiality issue as being very much akin to the solicitor-client privilege confidentiality, right? You have to have, in order to reach good consensus on policy and to have the best policies possible, the ability to debate those policies in a confidential way so that people, cabinet ministers around the table, are free to speak their mind. And they need to gather information, and that can be information from colleagues, from staff, and even from the public that they bring to the cabinet table. And so those cabinet member mandate letters are merely the beginning of a process. And the IPC commissioner, in terms of making the ruling, took an extremely narrow view of the operation of government and kind of viewed those mandate letters as being an end in themselves when they were actually the start of a process. And, you know, I want to say one thing, because I don't think people really understand this in Canada. Our Constitution is not just the British North America Act. Our Constitution is made up of dozens of statutes, plus the constitutional conventions of a Westminster government. That's our Constitution.
Well, absolutely. But let's just step back for a minute, because a lot of people will have a knee-jerk reaction to the zones of confidence notion and say, well, what this is, you know, this is government. Government should be held accountable and should be all open, and everything should be open and transparent. But, I heard a long time ago that famous saying that, if you like sausages, that's fine, but you don't want to see how they're made. I think that that's true in terms of government policy as well. But let's put it in a different context. And you talked about this and the importance of zones of privacy to allow for the free exchange of idea without fear of repercussion. And you mentioned the lawyer-client relationship. And certainly in the lawyer-client relationship, it's absolutely imperative that the client feel that they have the freedom and confidence to tell the lawyer everything. As a lawyer, if you don't know everything, you cannot possibly defend or prosecute a case appropriately. I mean, something will come out, and you'll have taken a strategy that will be effective. And let me put it in another context that probably everyone is familiar with. Another zone of confidence, the doctor-patient relationship. If there was no zone of confidence between a doctor and a patient, people wouldn't tell their doctor everything that the doctor needed to know, because they'd be afraid, for example, that certain things might get out into the public or whatever, that might be some issue, personal issue, and if they thought the doctor's records were subject to disclosure or publication, they'd hold back. And if they held back with their doctor, that could have very, very serious repercussions in terms of diagnosing what's wrong with them and hopefully finding a cure or a treatment. So all of these types of relationships, as you mentioned, they absolutely, by necessity, must have a zone of confidence. And similarly, government, in some instances, must have a zone of confidence. They must be free to kick around things that, on second thought or at some later point, might not be popular. But they need to think about it, they need to be able to discuss it, and they need to be able to do so in a way that is free from the looking over your shoulder fear that it's going to be on the banner of the cable network news.
Well, I think it's even worse than that. Essentially, what CBC News and the journalists and the entire mantra of greater transparency, 100% transparency, 100%. Accountability, 100% public participation, really seems to want to get to is get into the mind of the premier and the cabinet ministers themselves. They're like, it's not just looking over the shoulder, it's getting inside the brain. What is that person thinking? Who did that person talk to?
I mean, that type of forensic review, I mean, I can only imagine. I'm thinking about some historical figures who were, I think all would agree, great leaders, your Winston Churchill's, your John Kennedy's. One One can only imagine if you were entitled to every single shred of personal detail and personal conversation, or every discussion that they had in a cabinet room, what their legacy would be.
No, it's look, I just when I read this case and I read the decision, and I hear opposition politicians in particular saying that the decision is undemocratic, my jaw drops, because the Supreme Court of Canada gets it right. And in terms of looking at all the political analysis, look, this is one of those cases that really shows how politics and courts collide. And the Supreme Court of Canada gets it right when they say that in Canada's constitutional democracy, the confidentiality of cabinet deliberations is a precondition to responsible government. Isn't that the bottom line? We want responsible government. We want effective government and efficient government. And in having that kind of a government, it requires cabinet ministers to be able to freely debate ideas free from the public view. I mean, let's take a look at it from the opposite end. If you disclose those cabinet mandate letters right at the beginning of your legislative session, you're going to have all kinds of lobbyists and stakeholders pounce on those letters right away before any deliberations ever take place, and then influence government policy in a way that government policy perhaps should not be influenced.
Yeah, I'm almost as I think about what the IPC in this case and the opposition and the media. Of course, the media is keen on this because it's all content for media. I mean, it's almost like turning a cabinet deliberation into an episode of, you know, a reality TV show of like the Keeping Up with the Kardashians. We're going to see every moment of the day, what every terrible thing that happens. We're going to follow them around with cameras, and we're going to turn government into a, as I said, a reality TV show. And it's great for media because it's easy, free content that they get to continuously publish. But I think that you're right. I think responsible government is a critical issue. Responsible means that government is entitled to deliberate about things that are not necessarily going to be popular. They are entitled to consider issues that are difficult. They have to consider all those issues from all sides. And the notion that they should be restrained or afraid to do things because they're being filmed like they would be on The Real Housewives, I think is absolutely not responsible. And it's irresponsible of media to be seeking to turn what is a important process, a deliberative process, a process that by definition should be held in confidence, into what is effectively a reality TV show.
I think that's a very apt analogy. And that's exactly what's happening, right? Journalists basically want to get right inside that cabinet room and turn their news into these episodes of reality television. And, you know, I got to tell you, reality television is certainly great from a comedy standpoint. But frankly, I don't want to see the lives of everything that's going on. I don't want to see what goes in those sausages.
You know, it's funny. We hear about responsible is a critical word. And one of the great defenses to a libel claim for media is responsible journalism, which is the sense that they've acted with integrity in publishing a story. And that they've gotten all sides of the story and they've tried to put a balanced approach for. And if they do that, of course, they have a defense, complete defense, to a libel claim. But responsibility is a two-way street. And I think that, you know, as I delve into this desperate need to find dirt, the dirt digging constantly to find copy for what is now an insatiable media appetite for content, clickbait, for lack of a better word, is really not responsible journalism. We've really descended, I think, right now into responsible journalism is defined as inquiring minds want to know. And if we back in our day, we're both old geezers, but you know, the National Enquirer, that was their mantra, was inquiring minds want to know. But nobody would have thought that was proper journalism. But it seems that to a large degree, mainstream media has descended to the level of the National Enquirer's standard of journalism. Inquiring minds want to know is enough.
Well, and you're absolutely right on that point, Gavin. It's to me responsible government is one thing. The word responsible is important. Effective government is another thing that is extremely important to the entire discussion here on this particular issue. But at the end of the day, the media view of 100% transparency, which they continue to want to push, does not lead to a responsible or effective government. And look, government can't be paralyzed. Otherwise, nothing gets done. You then have dithering governments that make all kinds of announcements at the start, which end up in the media. You have all kinds of lobbying that takes place, and then nothing gets done because cabinet can't really freely speak about ideas. You know, we look at it in terms of, I look at it from this perspective. There are checks and balances in government. So if the concern of the media is that not disclosing cabinet mandate letters and specific policies that a government discusses will lead to corruption in government because nobody knows who politicians are necessarily speaking to, we have auditor generals in place. We have other checks and balances in government to ensure that that government does not act in a corrupt way. You have complaints. You have the Integrity Commissioner's Office where complaints can be made. There are all kinds of checks and balances that can be used, and those offices have powers to actually dig into the issues without the media needing to have a full and open disclosure of everything that takes place in government. So, you know, I want to back up a little bit with respect to freedom of information legislation. And what is freedom of information legislation designed to do? And what is its purpose? Because the purpose of the legislation is actually a key underpinning to this decision. It's a matter of statutory interpretation at the end of the day as to what that cabinet records exemption meant within the freedom of information legislation. And that applies really all across Canada. Freedom of information and legislation is generally the same. So freedom of information legislation as a basic concept is designed to promote transparency, accountability, and meaningful public participation. But at the same time, it has necessary exceptions that are, they're limited and they're specific, and the cabinet record confidentiality is one of them. So the act in and of itself draws a balance. And that was really, when you look and dig into this decision, that was the mistake, the unreasonableness of the IPC commissioner's decision was to not carefully examine what that balance meant. And he had to take a factual and contextual approach to the decision, and in that decision, weigh the constitutional conventions that are inherent and sit at the foundation of our constitutional democracy.
Yeah, I think it's not hard to imagine. I mean, as much as there is an appeal and the bully pulpit of media at the moment is certainly to focus on this sort of hidden agenda type storyline that they put in everything. But governments are judged, quite frankly, on what they do. There's got to be a deliberative process, as you point out, where a lot of issues and points of view are considered in order for governments to get to the point of actually doing something or affecting people's lives, and that is really what representative democracy is about. And it's funny when we look at these decisions. You mentioned that there are 9 judges on the Supreme Court of Canada. There are 3 judges on the Ontario Court of Appeal. We had a dissent in the Ontario Court of Appeal. But, you know, what a zone of confidence. I mean, judges hear a case, particularly appeal court judges, a panel of judges, and they will often stand up and say, or reserve decision, which they did here. And they'll go back, and what will they do? They'll kick it around. They will discuss between them to try to come to ground on a decision, because most decisions, frankly, are unanimous. If you see most appeal courts, it's very unusual to see dissent. It happened in the Court of Appeal. But those deliberations between judges while they talk about the various aspects of the cases, there's a zone of confidence right there. Would anybody be suggesting that that should be a recorded and public and open debate where judicial officials are arguing between themselves or debating issues? Of course not, because that would be absolutely appalling. What you want from the judiciary is you want them to have that opportunity to float those trial balloon errors, pardon the pun, as to what these issues are. Are they important? What is the consequences of this? How does it fit within the rubric of the existing jurisprudence, etc.? You want them to be able to have those free discussions so that they come out with a finished product in terms of a decision that is meaningful and helpful and advances the law. That's exactly what you want. So another zone of confidence where it's quite important to have those type of deliberations remain confidential.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to take it one step further because I got to tell you, the media has painted this decision incorrectly, and in some cases they have really provided an unbalanced view. Just because some other premier decided to release the mandate letters doesn't mean that all premiers must release their mandate letters. But could you imagine that any discussion at the editor's table as to how they are going to paint the narrative of a story, if that were to be made public, do you think the media would be happy to have those discussions made public as they sit around? Well, how do we get so-and-so politician because we don't like them?
Yeah, look, I mean, the reality of this is that the media was a party in the lawsuit. The media who are telling the story of what happened were in the game. It would be like a member of one of the hockey teams writing the story about the hockey game. They were in it. It was their case. That's number one. Is that they certainly had an interest all the way through in getting there. But I think you're absolutely right that there are all sorts of discussion, including those go on around the editorial board, and including those of what's your assignment as a reporter. In order to follow around some, I can think of one politician that had his own dedicated team of reporters that were assigned to follow him around. He shall remain nameless, but you can probably guess who it is. Was that going to come out? Yes, we've targeted this individual. Were those discussions going to be made public? Of course not. I think you're absolutely right. But I think the unbalanced view comes from the fact that they were involved in the case.
For sure. And, hopefully I'm not on the ceiling too high here. maybe that's why the ceiling crumbles are falling on my head over here, because I've gone through it and I'm up on the next floor. I shake my head when and this is really what gets me going is the opposition. In response to a very, very reasoned decision from the Supreme Court of Canada, continues to go and make comments that it's anti-democratic. And really what bothers me with respect to some of these politicians is they have acted in government themselves, and they know that there are secret meetings, they're called in-camera meetings, that take place that the public has no input into whatsoever, that is completely non-transparent, because discussions need to take place in private before decisions can be made.
Well, I mean, look, I mean, you mentioned something about other premiers releasing mandate letters. I mean, let's just step back and think about that for a minute. So then if mandate letters now are going to become public statements, okay, that's fine, but that's not relevant. How did those mandate letters come to pass? What were the discussions that led to the creation of the mandate letters? Where are the prior drafts of the mandate letters? Where other particular issues were talked about? I mean, where does it end? We talk about opposition. Are they going to be, when they take positions, for example, are they going to be revealing everything? Are they going to be having a reality TV show of their caucus meetings? or of their individual meetings with their advisors where they come up with their policies or their positions? Of course not. People are entitled to think about things. People are entitled. Families do this all the time. You're entitled to have private quarrels within your family and come out and how you have show your public face is maybe different than what happens behind closed doors. And so it should be. If you don't have zones of privacy, it's impossible to live. We are not in all deciding to move into a fishbowl, and government shouldn't be in fishbowls either, in my view. And what they come out with, that they should be judged on what they do. They should be judged on the public policies that they state as public policies. Absolutely. They should be judged on the results of those policies. But if we restrict them and create an atmosphere of fear and concern and you're always campaigning and never governing, I think we've got a real problem in having a responsible government in Canada.
As I said, you just end up paralyzing governments entirely. You know, a minority government would be a very good example of how the paralysis would work. Could you imagine in a minority government, any deliberations with the opposition trying to strike that deal were to be made public?
Oh, well, they want to have cameras in the room. They want to have cameras in the room to hear what everybody said, what the look on their face was. Look at that. And then we get clickbait of, well, so-and-so said this, if even if it was just facetiously and or as testing a proposition. And what would happen? No one would say anything because they'd be afraid that they'd be quoted out of context. They'd be afraid if they raise an issue that they'd be imbued with that issue and it would be tattooed all over them in the media. So they would never raise this. What would we have? We'd have everybody sitting there trying to come up with campaign slogan all the time without actually deliberating or doing any of the hard work to test theories and to put forward things that may be unpopular but necessary.
Well, and there'd be great fear to express any form of opinion whatsoever, legitimate opinion, and to actually push the debate to really get anything done. And so that's why when I read this decision and I read the response to this decision, I come out very, very fired up with respect to this issue. That how dare the opposition really try to whether it's direct or indirect, but undermine the Constitution of our country that allows our governments to actually get things done.
Yeah, and kudos to the Supreme Court of Canada for rising above the noise, as they often do, and getting to the heart of the matter and seeing the larger issues rather than just the moment to moment. Inquiring minds want to know, and I need some copy for my next story view that has been put forward, I think, in the media and in the reporting on the decision. And I think that this podcast may be one of the only ones where the Supreme Court is getting applauded for having the courage to do that and come to the right answer, in my view. And thankfully, when the Supreme Court says it's the law, it's the law.
Well, and until some other Supreme Court candidate panel 20 years from now or 50 years from now decides differently. But when you dig into the decision, and it's a very good read because, if you're a student of political science in particular, you don't even have to be really that well versed in law. But from a political science perspective, this is a very educational kind of decision on that level as well. And as I said, I think earlier on, the Supreme Court of Canada got it right at the end of the day, in my opinion.
And I think that on that note, thanks very much for listening to this very exciting and hopefully engaging discussion of a decision that has not received, in our view, the appropriate appreciation that it deserves. I'm pleased to say that the steam coming out of Stephen's ears has calmed down by the end of the episode. I just his headphones are very grateful. Please leave us a rating if you can, or any comments, concerns. If you disagree, more than happy to hear from you as well. In fact, probably want to more hear from you. So please send this podcast along to a friend if you can. And thanks very much for joining us on this episode of Beneath the Law. And always remember, if no one is above the law, then everyone is beneath it.